The headlines. Sudan's information minister tells Press TV that U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with Israel. A funeral has been held in Damascus for Syria's top diplomat and veteran Foreign Minister Wadah Damadam, who died earlier today at the age of 79. And Pakistani authorities block a major road into the capital, Islamabad, for a second day to prevent thousands of anti-French president protesters from entering the city. Hello, welcome to This Is News. Thanks for joining us. Sudan's Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh says that U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Saleh made the revelation in an exclusive interview with Press TV.
Until maybe the last 2 weeks before the American election, and I think it was Sudan was used as a card in the elections. Trump wanted to have some cards in his favor. Part of it is convincing some Arab countries to normalize relationship with Israel. So it was linked directly. Sudan was put under a very heavy pressure. In the last week, it was said clearly, this is linked. If you want Sudan to be listed, delisted from the SST, then you have to normalize the relationship with Israel.
Israel and Sudan agreed to normalize ties in a U.S. brokered deal in late October. The African country followed the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in agreeing to establish formal ties with Israel. Sudan took the step after a U.S. decision to remove the African country from its list of terrorism sponsors in exchange for $335 million to American terror attack victims. The normalizations with Israel have drawn widespread condemnations from Palestinians. They've described the agreements as a stab in the back and a betrayal of their cause. The funeral has been held in Damascus for Syria's top diplomat and longtime foreign minister Wadah Damadam. Senior government officials attended the mourning procession. Damadam died early on Monday. There are no details on the cause of his death. But the 79-year-old diplomat was in poor health for years with heart problems. Wadah Damadam was an important figure in Syria's political system. A correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, says that it is still not clear who will replace Wadah Damadam as Syria's foreign minister.
A couple of condolences letters were received in Syria. We have the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, who sent a letter of condolences to Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. He said Mr. Zarif said that Al-Muallim spent all his life playing an important role in serving and defending the national interests of his country and also the security of his country. We have the Russian Foreign Ministry, which also sent a letter of condolences to the Syrian government. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said that Russia lost a very close friend in the Arab world, who was a trusted partner and an experienced politician and diplomatic figure. Oman also tweeted, the foreign ministry said that it expresses condolences over the loss of Walid Al-Muallim and spoke about how significant his contributions were in the diplomatic field on both the regional and international levels. Still, we don't know who will the next foreign minister be in Syria. Analysts believe that it is highly believed that it will be most probably his deputy, Dr. Faisal Al-Maqdad.
Wadah Damadam started his political career in the 1940s. He was an important, in the age of 40, he was an important figure in Syria's political system. Here's a brief report on the highlights of his career.
Walid Muhyiddin Al-Muallim, a veteran Syrian diplomat, has died at the age of 79. He was Syria's vice prime minister and minister of foreign affairs and expatriates. There are no details on the cause of his death, but Muallim was struggling with poor health and heart problems for years. The veteran diplomat started his political career at the Syrian Foreign Ministry in 1964 and served in Syrian missions in Tanzania, Saudi Arabia, Spain, and England. In 1975, Muallim became the country's ambassador to Romania. After serving as Syria's ambassador to the United States from 1990 to 2000, Muallim was named as assistant foreign minister. In 2005, Muallim was appointed as deputy foreign minister, and a year later, he became Syria's minister of foreign affairs. When the war in Syria broke out in 2011, Moallem took to the media and slammed the U.S. for supporting terror groups in the country. In 2012, Moallem spoke at the United Nations and blamed the U.S. and its allies for intervening in Syria's affairs, mainly by supporting terrorists with arms and money. In 2013, he pushed for political peace with opposition groups by calling on them to join a new cabinet and rejecting foreign intervention. In another attempt to reach an agreement with Syrian opposition groups, Moallem participated in the Geneva Conference on Syria at the Swiss town of Montreux in early 2014. Moallem always defended Syria's territorial integrity and condemned the foreign interference that led to a war in his country.
Pakistani authorities keep a highway into the capital Islamabad sealed off for a second day to prevent thousands of anti-Macron protesters from entering the city. The move comes after a mass rally was held in the neighboring city of Rawalpindi for a second day. Protesters condemned what they called the French president's support for blasphemous cartoons of Islam's prophet Muhammad. The road was sealed off to prevent protesters from marching to the French embassy. Muslims angry at the sacrilegious cartoons have been demanding the closure of the mission over the past weeks. Pakistan has already lodged a complaint with France over what Islamabad describes as Paris's anti-Muslim repression and systematic Islamophobic campaign. Javed Rana is our correspondent who joins us from Islamabad to tell us more. Javed, at this point, what are we looking at when it comes to these protests against France?
Well, I think government is, in fact, very fearful. Government fears that these protesters could possibly march towards the French embassy and can storm it. In early this month, there was a violent protest, and the protesters had attempted to reach towards the French embassy. I think because of those reasons, the government has blocked major highways. They are trying to prevent those protesters, but at the same time, government yesterday and today also, they are also preventing more protesters to reach to the capital city. Now they are basically at the juncture, a very important traffic juncture, where they have not stationed themselves. And the government has so far launched two operations, one of which was, a massive security operation, which started at around 3 a.m. This morning. And I have seen a huge cache of the leftover ammunitions, rubber bullets, some gas canisters. That indicates that the government has used every conceivable method to make it sure that they vacate that particular juncture. That has not happened. I was in the protest an hour ago, and I have met those protesters. I have seen them, and I think they are very angry. They are very determined. They told me that no matter what happens, they are here to get what they call as martyrdom. Now, in case if any of them is killed in any security operation, that will be political disaster for the government. Right now, what the government is doing, government is simply mutated. Government is not telling the people what they intend to do on their basic demand of expelling French investor. What government has done, government has influenced the mainstream media, which has largely skipped the coverage of this protest. And it is the only things are happening only on the social media. They're trying to contain the more people coming to this protest. But that policy is not going to work, because the blockage of the main traffic interchange, that has caused lot of problems for the people. And this is not something which is tenable for in days to come. Now, if the government does not negotiate with them, I think there are more troubles in the pipeline. And many people are giving advice to the government to accept one of their demand, at least one of their demand, to expel French ambassador. That is not going to be a big thing. But in case there is a security operations against them, I think the situation could possibly can go out of control, something which happened back in 2017 when there was a similar situation, and there were protests all over the Pakistan, violent protests all over Pakistan, and the houses of the politicians were attacked. God forbid that doesn't happen again. So I think the best advice that the government is being given by some of the politicians is to negotiate with them. But bigger trouble here in Pakistan is also media itself. Media has developed over the period of time a kind of bias, and they're trying to see such protests from the Western perspective. And little do they know that the West is not a freedom of expression. It is essentially a politically motivated move to commit a blasphemy against the Prophet of Islam. to cause anger among the Muslims and then declared that the Muslims are terrorists. This is their old strategy. And unfortunately, that is not being reflected in Pakistani media, because of which now it appears that nothing is happening in Pakistan. If you look at Pakistani media, they are discussing all kind of political stuff. The one thing that they are not discussing is this protest and the international politics attached with the blasphemy of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Javed Manor, correspondent there, talking to us from Islamabad. The senior Iranian official has criticized the U.S. Secretary General's silence in the face of the, quote, gross violation of the rights of Iranians by the U.S. and certain Western countries. Head of the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights, Ali Bagheri Khani, said that there is no logic in Antonio Guterres' indifference in the face of U.S. sanctions and its effects on people's livelihoods. He said an official letter has been sent to the U.N. chief's office in this regard. The senior official also slammed the draft anti-Iran resolution on the situation of human rights at the U.N. General Assembly. He said the resolution has no legal standing and is not based on facts. Bagheri Khani said the countries that sponsored the resolution have a dark history of human rights violations themselves. The Armenian foreign minister has stepped down amid growing pressure on the government over a recent peace deal with Azerbaijan. The ministry spokesman announced the resignation of Zohrab Natsakhanian. He had held the position since May 2018. It came a week after Armenia signed a Russia-brokered deal with Azerbaijan that ended 6 weeks of fighting over the Nagorno-Karabakh. The agreement secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan. The government of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has been under pressure since it agreed to the accord. Anti-government protests have been raging in Armenia, with demonstrators calling for Pashinyan's resignation. The protesters consider the deal as a victory for Baku and a defeat for Yerevan. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. Moldova's opposition candidate Maia Sandu has won the country's presidential election. According to the preliminary results, Sandu has won over 57% of the votes in the second round of the runoff against 42% of the incumbent president Igor Dodon. The pro-Russia president has already conceded his defeat, asking his supporters to refrain from violence. Speaking to reporters after her victory, the pro-European president-elect also vowed to maintain a true balance in foreign policy and pragmatic dialogue with the West and Russia. Sandu also said that she would make it her priority as the president to tackle corruption and unite the country. Fred Weir is a journalist and political analyst joining us from Moscow. Vladimir Sotnikov is a strategic analyst, Russian Academy of Sciences, who also joins us from Moscow. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first ask your reaction, Fred Weir, if I may, about these opposition candidates choosing here, Maria Sanda, to the post that she has.
Well, we use this shorthand. We say pro-Western and pro-Russia, and it gives people the impression that there is some, you know, tectonic change taking place, whereas it's more or less Moldovan politics as usual. It is the poorest country in Europe. It's sunk in multiple crises. Corruption is rife. They have the coronavirus with a vengeance. And it is a parliamentary republic, not a presidential one. So there's not very much a president can do to seriously change things one way or the other. She is, Maia Sandu is pro-Western. She's a former World Bank economist. So she will, in little ways, steer Moldova closer to the EU. But even there's very little that can be done. Moldova is in no way ready to join the EU. So really, not much will change.
Okay, Vladimir Sotnikov, maybe you can tell us the significance of this in terms of why Moldova even matters when it comes to it being discussed in the news in the first place. I mean, what is the significance of this country? Well, perhaps we don't have him. Fred Weir, tell us the significance that Moldova has, for people who may not be familiar with it, and why this would be important to even be discussed in the news.
It doesn't have much importance. It's a little tiny country, a sliver, that was separated from Romania during the Russian Empire. It was called Bessarabia then, and the people are Romanian-speaking there. they don't have much weight in the region one way or another. And about a third of the population has emigrated in recent years because it's so poor and the opportunities are so slim in that place. So I think it's just this pro-Russia versus pro-Western thing that attracts headlines, at least in the West. They see it as one of these great Manichaean struggles, like Ukraine and Belarus. Everything gets looked at through that prism. But on balance, I don't think by tomorrow morning's news cycle anybody's going to be thinking about Moldova.
Is there going to be any type of effort by the U.S. to pull it into its sphere of any kind, or even the EU for that matter?
Sure. That's always going on. All these countries around the rim of Russia are constantly subject to geopolitical competition. Moldova is the least important of them. But yes, I think that's true, that there will be all kinds of shenanigans. Very little will be done to help Moldova, because it really does need a lot of help. But as I said, it is such a screwed up place that nobody's going to actually want it in the EU. Nobody's going to want it in NATO. And as you heard the new president say, Maya Sandu, that she will pursue a balanced foreign policy, which means trying to keep relations open with Russia and the West in order to extract whatever benefits she can get from both sides for her very impoverished little country.
Thank you very much for that. Fred Wirth, journalist and political analyst there from Moscow. And that does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Moderna company says its vaccine has been 94.5% effective in preventing COVID-19. The U.S. company says the vaccine shows encouraging results based on data from a large trial testing. The results come 1 week after similar results from another U.S. company, Pfizer. The vaccine developed by Pfizer in collaboration with Germany's BioNTech is more than 90% effective. Both companies are pending more safety data and regulatory reviews required for U.S. authorization. However, the World Health Organization says the vaccine will not end the pandemic on its own.
We knew that a vaccine would be essential for bringing the pandemic under control, which is why WHO proposed the ACT Accelerator. But it's important to emphasize that a vaccine will complement the other tools we have, not replace them. A vaccine on its own will not end the pandemic.
The Director General of WHO added that communities still need to be engaged and individuals need to be careful in order to fully contain the pandemic. The coronavirus has so far infected more than 53 million people worldwide. The total death toll stands at over 1.2 million. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to data from Johns Hopkins, the number of coronavirus infections in the U.S. increased by more than 136,000 between Tuesday and Wednesday, that is November 11th and 10th, while over 1,420 Americans died from COVID-19 during that time period, bringing the death toll to roughly 240,000. The U.S. is heading for a dark winter, a COVID hell, the darkest days of the pandemic. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID-19 Soars to New Heights in the U.S. Here's the details of this article. I hope we don't run out of mobile morgues, is what epidemiologist Eric Figelding said in response to data demonstrating the out-of-control nature of the coronavirus pandemic in the United States of America, which became the first country to surpass 10 million COVID-19 infections, and whose healthcare system is expected to be overwhelmed. We are in an unbelievably dangerous moment with coronavirus where the full weight of governments at all levels needs to be focused on saving lives, tweeted David Dayen, journalist. As Dayen wrote in the American Prospect on Wednesday, November 11th, the world's worst coup attempt is going to get a lot of people killed. The figures are indeed harrowing. As CNBC reported on Wednesday, November 11th, Ohio has had an unprecedented spike in COVID-19 hospital admissions. ICU beds in Tulsa, Oklahoma are full. North Dakota's hospitals don't have enough doctors and nurses. And hospital administrators in Iowa are warning that they are approaching their limits. The U.S. is heading for a dark winter, a COVID hell, the darkest days of the pandemic. However you describe it, the next few months of the coronavirus pandemic will be unlike anything the U.S. has seen yet. According to data from Johns Hopkins, the number of coronavirus infections in the U.S. increased by more than 136,000 between Tuesday and Wednesday, that is November 11th and 10th, while over 1,420 Americans died from COVID-19 during that time period, bringing the death toll to roughly 240,000. Figelding expects the U.S. to hit 200,000 new cases per day by the end of November, if we continue this rate. This is incredibly worrisome to public health officials because, as The Atlantic reported recently, November 10th, there is already a nationwide surge of COVID-19 hospitalizations, which are now at an all-time high. We have not even come close to the peak, and as such, our hospitals are now being overrun. Michael Sternholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, told CNBC. The next 3 to 4 months are going to be by far the darkest of the pandemic, he said, who is a member of Biden's Coronavirus Advisory Board. As Figelding pointed out on social media, deaths usually lag cases by about 3 weeks. Despite the rhetoric offered by President Donald Trump about a plunge in the deadliness of the virus, the link between new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths has been consistent for months, the Washington Post reported on Tuesday, November 10th. Folks, with so many record highs, we are going to hit 200,000 new cases per day by the end of November. If we continue at this rate, deaths usually lag cases by 3 weeks. As Dan put it, the executive branch has completely checked out on any responsibility for this massive public health crisis at precisely the moment when the crisis is most acute. Apart from attention to the election and its chaotic aftermath, Americans are also focused on upcoming holiday season, which Dr. Isaac Bogo, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Toronto, said creates the potential for innumerable super-spreading events across the country that could introduce and reintroduce the virus to new areas and further exacerbate community transmission. Pandemic fatigue has fully set in at the worst possible time, Dayan said. Nonetheless, public health officials are still pushing for more people to wear masks, which they predict can prevent up to 130,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S. through spring 2021. Looking beyond masks, we know exactly what to do here, which is what makes the federal government's inaction so frustrating, Dayan argued. Restaurants, gyms, cafes, and indoor venues accounted for 80% of all new infections during the first 3 months of the pandemic, based on cell phone data, he wrote. If we just shut down these venues and pay them to stay closed, we would get a shockingly large handle on the situation, Dayan pointed out. Yet, we've had absolutely no discussion of this in the highest levels and no leadership in Washington looking seriously at this option. It's absolutely infuriating that we are going to consign people to death and suffering, he added, because nobody in the White House or Congress can be bothered.
Ocean of Dua.
إني أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil fa wa jahum wa listeners, brothers and sisters, previously, we started talking about the things we are not allowed to ask from the Almighty Allah. Those things we should not pray for to the Almighty Allah. We started talking about the norms of the Almighty Allah in universe and life. And we said that petitioning contrary to those norms of Allah in this universe and life is not allowed. The instance of which was the request of Prophet Nuh ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi wa salam from the Almighty Allah regarding his son, when he wanted to save his son from the floods that were about to come. But the Almighty Allah said that innahu laysa min ahlik, he is not of your family, innahu amalun ghayru salih, he is of the unrighteous conduct, fala tas'alni. So the Almighty Allah said, do not ask me of something you have no knowledge. So these norms and sunan of the Almighty Allah are among the necessary requirements when we are trying to supplicate to the Almighty Allah, since we have to know them prior to that, to our supplication, since the function of these norms will not be broken by our prayings and our supplications. And we have previously mentioned that what the prayings and supplications do is to direct a person to invoke Allah within these frameworks of norms and laws. The norms of the Almighty Allah are always the manifestation of His ontological will, and these rules and norms will not be violated. These are irada to takwiniya of the Almighty Allah.
ربنا آتنا في الدنيا حسنة وفي الآخرة حسنة وقنا عذاب النار وقنا عذاب النار.
And we have to know that the role of supplication is to try and attract the will of Allah, the Exalted, in favor of the supplicant. And the role of supplication and prayings is not to move against these norms. That is why Allah the Exalted says, and you will never find any revision in Allah's precedent. لَن تَجِدَ لِسُنَّةِ اللَّهِ تَبْدِيلًا. So the system which is prevailing in the universe is the embodiment of Allah's will, Allah's ontological will, which is iradatu takwiniyah, such that the universe cannot be in order without it. So it is not correct for the supplicant to ask for a big change, be it small or big, no difference, in the will of Allah. The prayer is among the doors of Allah's mercy for His servants, and the will of Allah is always in conformity with His mercy. And we should also know that no norm is different from the other, be it a universal norm or historical or social one. Each norm represents His will, and His will is a manifestation of His mercy and wisdom above which there is no mercy and wisdom. And that is why we have been recommended to ask for the Almighty Allah's mercy and that close station near Him, not to ask for whatever we think it is true.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har kujo keshti
of Panjarabad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you.
Not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
For more elaboration on this, let's suppose one of the norms of the Almighty Allah. For example, one of the divine social norms is that the members in a given society depend on each other in terms of their worldly and religious needs. And if this is the case, then it would not be appropriate for the supplicant to beseech Allah to make him independent of others and not to make him in need of them. For such a prayer, of course, indeed is standing in sharp contrast with this norm and will of the Almighty Allah. The Almighty Allah has ordered us to be together, to be united, and make a unity. And that is why we have many of the Almighty Allah's ahkam and many of his rules regarding the community of the Muslims. Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, "One day I prayed, O Allah, do not make me in need of any one of your creatures." So the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, "O Ali, never say such. There is no one except that he is in need of the people." So I said, "Then what would I say, Prophet?" He replied, "Say, O Allah, do not make me needy of the wicked among your creatures." Dear listeners, thank you for staying with us in this program as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. According to data collected in mid-October, nearly 24 million U.S. adults, 10.9% of the population, report that their households sometimes or often did not have enough to eat recently. Between 8 and 14% of adults with children reported that they could sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. Compare that to last year, where only 3.7% of adults reported their households going hungry during the entire course of 2019. Rates of hunger are much higher among Black and Latino households, where workers are more likely to work in low-income industries that suffered massive job losses due to the coronavirus pandemic. About 19% of Black households and 18% of Latino households reported not having enough food to eat, sometimes or often in the past 7 days. The Trump administration was in court last month, attempting to block emergency food assistance for the nation's poorest families. We're prepared for you an article written by Mike Ludwig. The piece is titled, 11% of U.S. Adults Go Hungry as Trump and McConnell Fixate on Challenging Election Results. Please stay with us for more of Mike Ludwig's article. Federal data shows nearly 11% of American adults, including up to 14% of adults living with children, report their households do not have enough to eat. Hopes that Congress will pass another pandemic relief package before the end of the year are growing dim, as President Donald Trump fixates attention on trying to overturn the election that he and the U.S. media projected lost. Economic recovery is slowing as the United States experiences a surge of COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths, threatening to send cities and states with high infection rates back into lockdown to prevent hospitals from becoming overwhelmed. The federal government estimates 10 million people, including 4 million children, will be pushed below the federal poverty line in late 2020, as unemployment benefit are set to expire in December without further relief from Congress. However, President Trump is now laser-focused on attempting to overturn the election result, pushing disinformation and conspiracy theories as his campaign files failing lawsuits challenging the vote. Recently, the U.S. media projected Joe Biden as the 46th President of the United States. According to the Washington Post, talks between the Trump administration and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on pandemic relief broke down last month, and administration officials have indicated they are unlikely to take the lead on negotiations now, leaving the job on the GOP side up to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell attempted to normalize Trump's unprecedented behavior, arguing before the Senate recently that Trump has the right to challenge the election in courts of law. Congress has failed to agree on pandemic relief since passing a $2.2 trillion package in the spring that provided stimulus checks starting at $1,200, with all eyes on two upcoming runoffs in Georgia that could wrest the Senate from his control. Mitch McConnell has said that passing another pandemic relief package before the end of the year is a priority. However, McConnell is pushing for a highly targeted stimulus package similar to a $500 billion proposal that Democrats rejected months ago, arguing it did not provide nearly enough economic relief. Democrats are doubling down on their proposal, the HEROES Act, a $2.2 trillion package passed by the House earlier this year that includes around another round of $1,200 checks to each individual, along with badly needed assistance for state and local governments. Mitch McConnell has consistently refused to take up the package in the Senate, where conservatives are wary of social welfare spending, rebelled against compromise measures offered by the Trump administration and the moderates. Democrats already cut $1 trillion from the HEROES Act since the House originally passed the legislation in May. Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and other top Democrats are now demanding Republicans drop their support for Donald Trump's effort to overturn the election and pass pandemic relief. Nancy Pelosi said during a press conference on Thursday, 12th of November, "What are they thinking? People are suffering. They seem to have a mental block to doing the right thing." Analysts say Senate Republicans are not likely to embrace a strong stimulus package now that Pfizer has claimed preliminary data showing that its COVID-19 vaccine is 90% effective. However, a trial for the vaccine is ongoing and has yet to be approved by the federal regulators. Consumer advocates warned recently that Pfizer's preliminary data does not show whether the vaccine is safe or whether it will be effectively prevent COVID-19 in vulnerable populations. On Tuesday, 10th of November, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell claimed that unemployment has fallen to 6.9% as evidence that only a highly targeted stimulus package is needed. However, unemployment could spike again if the third wave of COVID-19 forces even more parts of the country back into shutdown. On Wednesday, 11th of November, Illinois issued guidance urging people to stay at home. And the city of Chicago will enter an official stay-at-home advisory beginning on Monday, 9th of November. Other states and cities will likely follow. A record 153,000 new COVID-19 cases were reported in the U.S. on Thursday alone, and the U.S. has seen over 1 million new cases in the past 10 days, more than any other nation in the world. According to the Economic Policy Institute, despite the positive jobs report claimed by Mitch McConnell, about 1 million Americans applied for unemployment insurance recently, more than any time during the Great Recession. Many workers are exhausting their state unemployment benefits as the pandemic drags on. The number of state claims dropped by 436,000 recently, and federal emergency unemployment benefits will expire on 26th of December without congressional action. Meanwhile, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the economy has not recovered from the damage caused earlier in the pandemic, as what little support is left from the initial relief package dwindles, and lower-income households and households of color are suffering the most. Nearly 80 million adults, about one in three, report not having enough money to cover basic expenses, such as food, rent, and medical bills, including 40% of households with children. According to the center's analysis of federal data, nearly one in six renters are behind on rent, including 26% of black families and 18% of Latino families. Some federal protections for renters are in place, but Democrats want a tougher eviction moratorium passed with a stimulus package. Attempts by landlords to evict their tenants have been reported across the country. According to data collected in mid-October, nearly 24 million adults, 10.9% of the U.S. population, report their household sometimes or often did not have enough to eat recently. Between 8 and 14% of adults with children reported that their kids sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. Compared to last year, when only 3.7% of adults reported their households going hungry during the entire course of 2019. Rates of hunger are much higher among black and Latino households, where workers are more likely to work in low-income industries that suffered massive job losses due to the coronavirus pandemic. About 19% of black households and 18% of Latino households reported not having enough food to eat, sometimes or often in the past 7 days. The Trump administration was in court last month attempting to block emergency food assistance for the nation's poorest families. Back on Capitol Hill, Washington, according to reports, Democrats and Republicans remain deadlocked over pandemic relief on Thursday, 12th of November, with Democrats pushing their $2.2 trillion proposal and attacking Republicans for focusing on Donald Trump's efforts to reverse the election results. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said he wants Congress to pass another stimulus package but continues to stand by his $500 billion offer. Mitch McConnell said, "I gather Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leader in the Senate still are looking at something dramatically larger." He added, "That's not a place I think we're willing to go."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of Sacred Defense and the cultivation of talents.
There are many books and movies about various wars, and we have read many of them, but such popular cooperation and assistance is completely unprecedented in the world. For example, such and such a young man from a village in such and such an area of the country, for example, a village in Kerman, would go to the city and would join the forces, and later he would become a personality like Haj Qasim Soleimani. So, a great movement was in place. Such and such a young student decided to join the front lines without having previously held a gun in their hands. And amid the war, he became an outstanding and influential figure in a very strategic military base in the space of a year and a half. For example, we could cite a youth who worked as a journalist in a certain newspaper and who later on would join the front lines, turning into a personality like Shahid Hassan Bakhri, a genius in the area of military intelligence, in less than no time.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
There was no shortage of such astonishing phenomena. Talents were cultivated, and eternal personalities and great martyrs were born in the war, some of whom I mentioned. I used to see some exemplary young officers, notably Shahid Sayyad, whom I knew from early revolutionary days. I think that at that time he was a young officer with the rank of a lieutenant or a captain. He was in contact with me and we used to see each other. However, he turned into an experienced and competent commander, able to guide and command the ground force of the Islamic Republic of Iran army for a long time and to participate in the most daring endeavors. The same is true of Shahid Babai and others. This innovative model of popular presence could always be employed. Today, too, we can benefit from this model.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.